is no joke. They love football. But what do people want from football? Why do they arrange everything in their lives based on football? The first answer is this: entertainment. Football is the best entertainment in the world. You only need to watch it to feel the miracle, the beauty of the techniques, the excitement of the sideline issues, the amazing tactics, and eventually the display of fate. You can find everything in football. Everything you need for happiness, sadness, surprise, or excitement. Even in the most boring matches, there are things that will make you remember them for weeks. After all, people always want to be entertained. That's why they watch movies or go on vacations or do thousands of other things. Football gives them this gift. What's more entertaining than being at a stadium and watching the most beautiful sport by mankind? But more importantly is the feeling of it. When people enter the stadium, they become members of a big society, a group with the same flag and colors, with the same slogans, the same goal, the same idea, and the same wish. You become united with thousands of people at the stadiums who sing the same song or laugh and cry for the same thing. It satisfies one of human beings' most basic needs, the tendency to socialize, the need to be united with others, the instinct to communicate with a group without the usual expenses for social relationships. Being a part of a coordinated society is the best feeling in the world. It's a feeling of sameness and cordiality, a feeling of esprit de corps. And the third reason is what we call catharsis.
Most amazing Champions League night this great crowd has ever seen. It's the greatest ever semi-final comeback in the history of the competition. Liverpool are into the final, and we will never ever forget quite how they did it.
Catharsis is the feeling the audience gets after listening to a masterpiece symphony or watching an impressive play. It's a kind of revolution inside you. It's a kind of spiritual experience. Football is a small example of our life. So merciless, so beautiful, and so fair. The most sorrowful tragedies along with surprises, achievements, and epics. The biggest protagonists next to the most detested antagonists in the most spectacular clashes. Watching football makes you feel that you're part of a bigger experience, a part of the common experience by human beings whose identity is exactly similar to our life. The experience of watching a good match is just like watching a play by Shakespeare. You have a strange feeling afterwards, a kind of pleasant lightness. People watch football for these things. The importance of the spectators can't be realized anywhere as much as in the World Cup. The World Cup is the most important event in the world of football. It's a headline of all the media in the world. Billions of people across the world watch it, All nations follow it. That's why a national team's participation in the World Cup is the biggest dream for its fans. They support their teams months ahead of the games, in World Cup qualification games, in friendlies, in practice sessions, and even at the airports. They're always everywhere, and they accompany their teams in the breathtaking path towards the World Cup. If a country's national team isn't used to regularly taking part in the World Cup, they hold large celebrations on the streets after qualification. Fans boost the players' spirits along the way to prepare for the World Cup. And they get ready and go to the stadiums on the other side of the planet to shout their country's names and support the players. This is a climax of human beings' love for football. Fans at stadiums are draped with their country's flags. Sometimes they paint their faces as a color of their flags. Sometimes they even bring symbols of their country and history to the stadiums. And it doesn't stop there. They have bizarre devices for cheering, sing long songs out loud. They have similar appearances and fantasy designs. It all turns the World Cup into a passionate and colorful carnival of different cultures. It's a chance for dialogue among civilizations, languages, religions, and human beings. The performance of the fans is the most representative of their nation's cultures. Japanese and South Korean fans are well-disciplined, indefatigable, and coordinated. Brazilians are full of energy and joy, and they never stop cheering their team. And the Britain's strategy to cheer their players is exactly what's dragged other nations into conflicts. The different cultures and approaches of cheering will be in the minds of everyone in the world for many years. It'll somehow become an image from the people in that country in the minds of the people in the world. As everyone knows the tiny country of Iceland with their fans' unique cheering, or the Vuvuzelas in the 2010 World Cup quickly found their ways to football matches everywhere in the world, or the Mexican Wave, which has been ongoing in big stadiums since 1986. Apart from all of these, World Cup fans have another major characteristic as well. They gather under the same national flag. Their most important goal is to support their national pride and gaining pride for the flag. The flag isn't tied to the identity of any club or individual. When a club loses, its fans might get upset for months, but when a national team loses, a country loses. Millions of people's national pride and their sports credibility are hurt. To be honest, the World Cup is a peaceful example of wars that's been fought between countries for centuries. Nowadays, countries don't fight each other with their missiles, they line up with their players and fans. Everything is like wars in the past. 11 players as fighters at the forefront and tens of thousands of fans as infantry behind them. The goal is to hoist the flag that covers all of them. Just think about the match between Argentina and Britain in the 1986 World Cup and what it meant for thousands of Argentine spectators at the Estadio Azteca in Mexico 4 years after their defeat in the Falklands War. Then you'll realize the crazy excitement of the spectators at the stadium. Or think about the spectators of the match between Iran and the U.S. at the Gerland Stadium and how they felt when both nations' flags were raised side by side. This is the main factor that differentiates spectators in a World Cup match from an ordinary match. The former aren't looking for excitement, they're looking for honor. They're trying to display their nation's culture. They're trying to immerse in the shadow of the flag to which they owe many things. The history of the World Cup is replete with spectators that if it wasn't for them, nothing in these matches would look like what it is now. The spectators are the soul of the World Cup. Think about July 16th, 1950, the final match with the largest number of spectators in history, when 200,000 Brazilian spectators were cheering their team like mad. When the biggest tragedy in the history of the country's football happened. Later on, in the 1970 World Cup, being a spectator had the meaning we know today. In most of the matches, over 80,000 people were at the stadiums, and some of them over 120,000 people. Many of them were foreigners. The huge numbers of spectators changed the face of many things. Television networks were now interested in broadcasting the matches. If the World Cup could take thousands of people from all across the world to a country, then why wouldn't it make millions of people sit in front of TV screens? Meanwhile, the large crowds would put a huge pressure on the referees in a way that the referees would make strange mistakes in favor of the hosts. It was that year when the world realized that the presence of so many spectators would give their country's tourism industry a boost. The high numbers of spectators changed the history of the World Cup. Now, the spectators were not just people who were sitting on the sidelines to watch the matches. They were an important part of the competition. They could impact everything. When Austria and Germany played in 1982 in a match that was suspected to be a match fixing, the fans at the stadium found out about it. They got so angry that they showed the players of both teams banknotes throughout the match as a sign of protests. Some of them even set their national flags on fire. The protests drew everyone's attention to the historical scandal. In the following years, in the final matches of the 1990 World Cup, the Italian spectators piled so much pressure on Maradona, who had defeated their team, to disturb him so he couldn't display his best show. They grabbed the cup from Argentina and gave it to Germany. When Maradona was shedding tears with a silver medal around his neck, the Italians seemed satisfied. And in the 2002 World Cup, we witnessed how South Korean fans pushed the referees to the most horrible mistakes. In fact, in the hell that the South Korean fans made, it was very hard not to make any mistakes. And today, World Cup spectators are not that different from the spectators 80 years ago. They're still so fanatic, so passionate about victory, and so excited. But something has changed. Now, the cameras turn to show them as well besides the field. The spectators who are sitting near the sidelines, despite their variety and large numbers, show the true meaning of the World Cup.
And we will go to penalties. And he's done it! And England win on penalties! It is Russia's party, and the party goes on! Oh, can you believe it? Fabulous comeback! Only eight now remain in Russia. Griezmann.
The fans go to the World Cup from all over the world. They stand by their teams and wholeheartedly shout for their victory. They represent their nations and countries just as much as the players do. They hold the flag that's a symbol of their identity and do their best for their honor and to make everyone feel proud. And this is what our world looks like, the world of the competition between different colors, ideas, and tastes, the world of the urge to win, the world of shouting, excitement, and confrontation.
Here is the planet's ultimate game, the final of the 21st Football World Cup.
Let's not forget that the World Cup isn't just about football matches. Let's not forget that football isn't just a sport. Millions of fans from scores of nationalities is an opportunity to think about this one question. What is football? This is called football. Watch it carefully.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Leaders meeting with eulogists and religious poets. On Thursday, 12th of January 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a number of eulogists, elegists, and religious poets at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. The meeting took place just one day before the anniversary of the birth of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Thursday, 12th of January, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a number of eulogists, elegists, and religious poets. In Shia Islam, elegists are authors of mournful poems lamenting the martyrdom or passing away of members of Prophet Muhammad's household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, and also lamenting the pain and suffering of this household, peace be upon them. Eulogists, on the other hand, are individuals who give speeches or recite poems containing great praise and reverence for members of Prophet Muhammad's household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. In Shia mourning ceremonies, eulogistic tributes and lamentations for the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, are very common. The philosophy behind elegy and eulogy is to promote kindness and goodness and virtue throughout society. Commenting on the subject of elegies and eulogies, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Elegies and eulogies are part of our heritage. It is heritage of the Shia Muslims. You elegies have come and turned it into a complex and hybrid art form. Today, elegies and eulogies are a form of hybrid art. It is art, or in other words, it is beautiful. Art is something beautiful after all. It is both beautiful and it creates beauty. You have combined several art forms together, the sum of which results in an elegy or a eulogy. A pleasant voice, this is the first art. The second art is good poetry. And a third art is a good melody. In addition, you need a good theme and good content. Because having a good poem is one thing, but it is another thing to have good content. A poem may be very good, but still lack a rich content, or it may contain flaws." Turning to the beauty of Shiite religious texts, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "I believe we have been holding these kinds of meetings for the past 40 years now, and when I look at these now compared to earlier years, the work that is being done is much more advanced and better in terms of the types of elegies and poetry that is recited now. There is no doubt about this. However, I would like to draw your attention to some matters. What you are doing is a form of hybrid art, and art is beauty. We know this from our religious texts including the Holy Quran, the Nahjul Balagha, the Sahifa Sajjadiyya, and many of our supplications. Regarding the Holy Quran, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, states in the Nahjul Balagha, Sermon 18, "It has a truly wonderful appearance. Wonderful here does not imply that it is just beautiful. It is stunningly beautiful. It has a wonderful appearance. That is how the Holy Quran is. It is second to none in terms of its beauty and in terms of its art." Turning to Arabic poetry, the leader said, "Almost all of the best Arabic poems, the sweetest and the most beautiful and eloquent Arabic poems, belong to the age of ignorance. Those poets were alive when the Holy Quran was revealed to the Holy Prophet, but none of them were able to find even a minute fault or flaw in the Quran, or claim that they could recite anything similar to it. It has been stated in numerous places in the Holy Quran, 'Then bring a chapter like it.' They were not able to produce even one verse similar to the verses of the Holy Quran." Turning to religious texts, the leader said, "The Nahjul Balagha possesses the utmost magnificence, logic and beauty. The same applies to the Sahifa Sajjadiyya, the Abu Hamza Thumali supplication, Imam Hussein's supplication on the day of Arafah, and various other supplications. They're all incredibly beautiful." The leader added, "Your art is a continuation of this art. This art can be said to be comprehensive when all of its parts are beautiful. It is not enough for just its appearance to be beautiful. The content must also be beautiful. As it says in the Nahjul Balagha, Sermon 18, 'The Holy Quran has a wonderful appearance, and inside it is deep in meaning.' I, of course, do not expect you to presume that you can produce something similar to it. No, but this is what you should have in mind. That is, the appearance should be beautiful, and the core needs to be filled with meaningful content and logic." Commenting on the art of a good elegy or eulogy, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "In addition to gaining understanding in elegies, there is also a stirring of emotions. This is also an important point. There is gaining understanding. This means that you are teaching people with the poems that you are reciting. many of the things we learn are from the elegies that elegists recite, things that we have already told others many times in simple language. But when the elegist or eulogist recites the same thing with a good voice and a good melody, it is as though we are hearing, understanding and learning something new. It increases people's understanding, of course, as a continuation of a program after a sermon. An elegy is not the same as a sermon. It has a different nature and a different reality. It gives understanding and it stirs emotions. We must not underestimate the emotional factors involved here. One characteristic that we, as Shia Muslims, have is that emotions are embedded in our teachings and impart understanding from the beginning to the end. There is an accumulation of emotions. This is less in others. Our lamentations, our elegies, our supplications and ziyarats are filled with emotions and stir emotions. Of course, the presence of emotions is not beneficial in the absence of reasoning. The good thing about imparting understanding in the Shia Muslim text is that, in addition to stirring emotions, it also gives people a depth of understanding. This is a feature that I have not seen in the non-Shia. That is, as far as I know, I have not seen it elsewhere. Of course, each one of these different religions, Islamic and non-Islamic, have certain attributes, but the culmination of attributes belongs to Shia Muslims. Turning to the role of elegists and eulogists during 8 years of sacred defence, the leader said, "Well, these emotional states have also aided the country at sensitive times, one being during the Holy Defence era. During that time, it was the elegists, the poets and the eulogists, these good poets who were truly able to prepare the atmosphere for the great epic event. I have read this verse of a poem many times before. We warm the devout and the faithful with the sharpness of our words. We strike the butterfly like the flame of a candle does." This describes your situation. We strike the butterfly like the flame of a candle does. Elegies played a great role in preparing the hearts and increasing the spirituality of the environment when sending our forces into the front lines during 8 years of sacred defence. Under nights of military operations, during the military drills at dawn, during the burial and funeral processions of the martyrs, in mosques and in Husseinias, on the battlefield and elsewhere. The holiness that was prevalent on the war fronts during the Holy Defence era was unprecedented and has never occurred anywhere in the world at any time in history apart from the early days of Islam. A major part of it was related to the elegies and eulogies, and another part of it was related to other factors. It has been the same in the years after the war and up until today. Elegies and eulogies have played a great role in various situations, particularly during the sedition of 2009. The massive rallies and marches on 30th of December of 2009, and on various other occasions. I'm repeating these things for you so that as elegists and eulogists you can understand your position, what you are doing and what you are capable of doing. This is my intention, thank God. There are many of you present here today. Commenting on the recent riots, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Consider the recent events. I would like to say something about them. Regarding the recent riots, the enemy's plot was comprehensive, but their calculations were wrong." This is important. The enemy's plot had no faults, However, the calculations they had made for implementing these plots were wrong. When we say that the enemy's plot was comprehensive, we're saying that all the major factors that a world power can use to disrupt and destroy a country, all of these elements, all of these factors were used. They lined up all of these elements. There was an economic dimension to this as well. Of course, the economic situation in the country was not good, and is still not good today. People's economic problems allowed the enemies to make use of this factor. Other factors included security factors, infiltrations, and espionage teams from all sides. There was an uproar of Iranophobia in the world. They began promoting Iranophobia in different forms in the months leading up to the unrest and rioting, using the propaganda tools at their disposal. The United States, the Zionists, and the global arrogance in general. Iranophobia, this is another factor. Rallying support from certain individuals inside the country began a while ago as well. This is another important factor. They provoked unrest using various motives in the country, including ethnic, religious, political, and personal motives. Deciding to betray the country because of petty things such as, why didn't you greet me properly, or why didn't you give me such and such? There was also element of widespread propaganda, such as television and satellite channels, social media, and the internet. These are all factors that the enemy had lined up. As a person who views, monitors, and understands these issues, in my heart I thought, how well has the enemy engineered this? It was well engineered. They had prepared everything in the right place and in the right amount. So, why didn't they succeed? Because one of the enemy's bases, the calculations it made, was wrong. Yes, the things that they were all very important and effective, and they do have an impact on certain countries. However, they were unsuccessful here. This is because the miscalculations that they had made about Islamic Iran. I will give two or three examples of the enemy's miscalculations. I have briefly mentioned some of these. They imagined that because of the economic problems that exist in the country, the Iranian nation would cooperate with the enemy's plots and subversion and separatism. But this was a definite miscalculation. They imagined that by using foul language and insults, they would be able to take the country's officials out of the picture and make them assume a passive role. They thought that they could create differences of opinion among high-level officials within the country. They hoped that one side would say, let's do such and such a thing, and the other side would oppose this, pitting officials effectively against one another. This, of course, is a problem which exists in the United States itself. It exists in the Zionist regime of Israel. It exists in some other countries as well. These differences prevent them from getting big things done. They imagined that they could create such differences here. This was part of their miscalculation. They imagined that by using petrodollars of a mercenary country of the United States, they could weaken the Islamic Republic's determination. But they were wrong, of course, because the will and determination of the Islamic Republic was stronger and more forceful. Their calculations were all wrong. They imagined that by inciting some mercenary elements to seek asylum in another country and by encouraging them to smear this country, our youth, our young people would become discouraged. But they were wrong, of course. Some went there, became refugees, and they also smeared Iran, but no one paid any attention to this smearing. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei went on to emphasize that hope and unity would keep together the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that these two factors are extremely important. In his concluding remarks, the leader wished success and prosperity on all the audience present.
Our fast-paced lives have been made possible by advanced technologies. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. Productions in this field have brought numerous social and economic advantages while generating billions of dollars in revenue, making them indispensable for Iran's economic growth. Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we're going to look at the activities of Iranian knowledge-based companies. We wanted to explore why their dedicated efforts are so important to the country. Plus, we will check out some of their contributions to the national economy as a whole. So, let's get started. We hear the phrase knowledge-based enterprise thrown around a lot these days, but some might be wondering what we mean by a knowledge-based company. Interestingly, there is no agreed-on definition because of the broad range of their activities. However, they all have one thing in common. They use intangible assets such as intellectual property and depend heavily on innovation as a competitive source. To get a clearer idea of knowledge-based enterprises, we visited one in Semnan province to understand what they do. With decades of experience, this company specializes in making various types of gas turbines, blades, and parts. All production here begins in the design room. Based on requirements, parts are designed, then a prototype is created using wax. Later, the wax models are used to create precise molds, which are then cast with metal. It produces products along the lines of exports, meaning that all production stages strictly follow national and international standards for quality and safety, making them compatible with international regulations and ready for market destinations abroad. Items manufactured here are used to make gas turbines. It supplies equipment to Iran's national gas distribution grids, which feed gas to cities, oil refineries, power plants, and other industries through pipes that stretch across the country. You might find it interesting that these advanced services and technologies were previously imported. This means there was a certain dependency on foreign companies to get such items, which created a lot of expensive complications. Knowledge-based companies such as the one we just mentioned are among the pioneers of indigenizing this technology, saving the country millions of dollars on imports. The beating heart of any knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here, new products are created after vast amounts of studies. It is where science and knowledge meet method and production. It is also the place where the quality of products is put to the test. But it's not just a single room. This company has dedicated vast amounts of space to these activities, which also house advanced lab technology and testing equipment. Generally speaking, knowledge-based companies employ specialists and university graduates that handle important tasks. These individuals are the glue or the bridge between knowledge and production. Highly skilled and expert staff is one of the main advantages of this competitive market. Like many businesses across the country, this firm has overcome many obstacles to enjoy its numerous achievements. One such challenge has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. However, it has come up with its own unique approach, which has turned this obstacle into a massive opportunity. All things considered, there are numerous investment opportunities in this production field, particularly regarding research and development of products that do not currently exist in the market. This knowledge-based company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its product list and optimize its production while improving items it already manufactures.
The company we just talked about is one part of the giant puzzle that makes up the knowledge-based industry. The government has supported the shift to a knowledge-based society for decades, yet this shift has been more apparent in recent years. Such support has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many economic advantages.
In 2010, Iran passed several laws promoting and supporting these enterprises, strengthening a legal framework for the growth of the knowledge-based ecosystem. These efforts have paid off in many ways. Since 2013, knowledge-based companies and startups have grown over 140-fold to 7,000 active units today. These firms make thousands of specialized technologies that have massively reduced the country's dependency on foreign imports. Moreover, these businesses have increased developments in the production of medical devices, energy, agriculture, ICT, aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, biotechnology, and so much more. In fact, Iran also exports a lot of specialized products. According to figures from the National Innovation Fund, tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. In total, presently, Iran's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. That's going off of statistics from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. These schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative, high-tech productions for exports. Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of handwoven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong, compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Hand-woven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create.
Most hand-woven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas.
Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the US-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades.
Industry participants say the US sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy. But the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down the road, the US imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic hand-woven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of handwoven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of handwoven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year, the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%.
All right, while I take a quick little break here, I'll be back shortly. Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're checking out a knowledge-based company that is saving the country around $20 million worth of imports annually by managing to produce inhaler capsules that we use to import from foreign countries through in-house knowledge, research, and technology. Stay tuned to find out how they did it.
Patients with asthma or dyspnea need to use inhalers to get the prescribed drug into their lungs. That requires not just the active substance of the drug, but also a sort of carrier to take the drug into your lungs before it is fully absorbed in your mouth, before it even gets down your trachea. You will find them mixed with the active substance in inhaler capsules that the inhaler punctures once you put the capsule in, which then you inhale.
Our journey begins in the storage room where they bring in the raw material, the active substance for these inhaler capsules in the form of tiotropium bromide. Now, this company produces 45 million of these inhaler capsules annually for the 150 to 200,000 patients in the country that are prescribed to use them. And they use not more than 1 kilogram of this active substance, this tiotropium bromide, to make all of these. Now let's check out the production line to see how it's actually made.
The raw material in the form of a small amount of tiotropium bromide, as well as the excipients, which would be the aforementioned carriers that mix with the active substance, are then sent to the production line along with the gelatin capsules themselves, which would later be filled with our formulation substance, the mixture of our active substance and the excipients.
So before we get into the actual production line, first they bring the raw material from the storage room to allocate, to determine what amount of each formulation material they need to bring into the production line. So that includes the active substance, the aforementioned tiotropium bromide, and the excipients, which is the additive substances. So once they've allocated the necessary amounts of those, they bring it to the production line, which we will check out now.
Perhaps the biggest challenge in this production line is the mixing of an infinitely small amount of active substance with the excipients to get a completely uniform mixture of our formulation substance that you would find inside the capsules. The production line would have to be sensitive enough to mix 18 micrograms of tiotropium bromide with 10 milligrams of excipients in a completely uniform way. 1 microgram, by the way, is 1/1000th of a gram.
There's actually very little substance in it. And that is because a capsule filling machine is capable of microdosing, which after we bring the formulated powder from the previous process, this machine can fill this container, this little capsule, with just 10 milligrams worth of powder, formulated powder, which is not a capability that a lot of capsule filling machines are capable of. So once this capsule is filled with our 10 milligrams worth of formulated substance, we then go to the container filling room.
The containers that have been filled with exactly 30 capsules are brought to be labeled, then packaged, to be sent back into the warehouse, to be sent to pharmacies, and get in the hands of patients. But before that happens, they need to go through one final stage of quality assurance. Because this company has managed to fully domesticize the production technology of this particular product, they're able to save 90% of the currency that would otherwise be spent on procuring this very product for the patients in the country through imports. That is $9 million worth of savings, and they're fully capable of doing that because their production line allows for even leftover for exports. Because of the competitive pricing of the aforementioned tiotropium bromide capsules, the value of the potential exports of this product is estimated to be around $30 million.
And now we're at the quality control lab, and one of the most important quality control procedures that they do is to test the actual performance of the formula and the capsule. So what they do is they use a regular inhaler as a normal patient would. They would insert the capsule in it and use the lung simulator. So they would insert the inhaler, and with the help of a vacuum pump attached to this flow regulator attached to the simulator itself, they simulate the flow of a normal human inhale and see how much of the formula is administered to different stages of the lung. Each of these circles has these holes on them, which gets exponentially smaller the lower you go, to the point that at the bottom you don't really even see any of these holes. And the residue left by the formula through this inhale, we test out to see how much of the formula is left on each stage, and then we would see whether the residue left measures up to the amount that we wanted it to, and that pretty much concludes the test, the performance test for our formula. And that also pretty much concludes this episode of Boaz Earth. Take care and bye-bye. For our final portion of the program, let's check out some news and trends in the knowledge-based industries. The activities of knowledge-based companies are not just limited to Iran's borders. They have also headed to Venezuela to kick off a tech and science fair showcasing Iran's latest technological achievements.
Nearly 80 Iranian firms participated alongside hundreds of Venezuelan companies in the fair. They offered products and services in numerous fields such as oil, gas, health, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, and machinery. The goal is to exchange experiences, knowledge, and services and deepen Iran's trade ties with the Latin American country. The expo was launched by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. During the ceremony, Maduro announced that 4 fuel-efficient Iranian car models would be assembled in his country and released into the Venezuelan market.
One trend we are seeing these days is the increased activity of biotech companies. In fact, right now, knowledge-based products from this sector hold 40% of the country's total pharmaceutical exports to show for it.
That's based on the Association of Manufacturers and Exporters of Medical Biotechnology Products. Biotech refers to the use of living systems and organisms to develop products. According to the association, these products have saved the country millions in foreign exchange. Additionally, these knowledge-based companies have made Iran self-sufficient in biotech production. This sector exports its products to European, Asian, and Latin American countries while competing with other items in the international arena.
That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire Bazaar team, thank you for tuning in and bye for now. Until then.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., at least 7 people have been killed in a mass shooting incident at Half Moon Bay, California, the second California massacre in just 3 days. 11 people were killed in the first massacre on Saturday, 21st of January. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Los Angeles Times has covered the story and tells us more. At least 7 people were killed in 2 related shootings in the beachside community of Half Moon Bay on Monday, 23rd of January, an act of violence that comes just 2 days after 11 people were killed in another shooting in Monterey Park. The suspected shooter, a 67-year-old resident of the community, was arrested about 2 hours after the shootings, sitting in a parked car at a sheriff's substation. Deputies with the San Mateo County Sheriff's Office first found 4 victims shot to death in the 12,700 block of the Cabrillo Highway in an unincorporated area of the county just before 2:30 p.m. on Monday, 23rd of January. A 5th victim was also found in the area and taken to Stanford Medical Center with life-threatening injuries, the sheriff's office said in a statement to the Los Angeles Times. Minutes later, in a nearby area, deputies found 3 more victims dead of apparent gunshot wounds. The motive for the shootings is still unknown, sheriff's officials said in a statement. The suspected shooter was identified as Zhao Chun Li after he was spotted sitting in his car at the San Mateo County Sheriff's Office substation in Half Moon Bay, just south of San Francisco. Video from ABC7 showed deputies taking a man to the ground in the parking lot. The man was wearing a white cap vest and red long-sleeve shirt underneath. Chun-Li was found at the substation at 4:40 p.m. local time. The weapon, believed to have been used in the shooting rampage, was also found inside his car. Half Moon Bay Mayor